It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Hundreds sentenced to death by Egyptian court. Death toll rises in that boat capsizing on Lake Albert in Uganda. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Nearly 530 Muslim Brotherhood supporters of ousted Islamist Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi have been sentenced to death following a two-day proceeding that Washington denounced as shocking. VOA's Elizabeth Arendt reports from Cairo.
The condemned were convicted of killing a policeman, attacking others, and destroying property. The sentencing came after just two court sessions and before the defendant's lawyers say they were permitted to make their case. The majority was condemned in absentia, with fewer than 200 of those on trial in court. 16 suspects were acquitted. An appeal is permitted, and given the rushed circumstances of the trial, human rights and legal experts believe the verdict is unlikely to stand. Even members of the government-linked National Council for Human Rights condemned the verdict. Member Nasser Amin wrote on Twitter, "The court ruling will be overturned as soon as the defendants demand a retrial." Other legal rights advocates described it as a disaster and a scandal. Many of those on trial were arrested during fighting in the southern province of Minya, where the trial was held, after security forces dispersed Muslim Brotherhood protest camps last August in Cairo. Hundreds, possibly more, died in the crackdown, most of them supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood and Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first freely elected leader. Thousands of Morsi supporters have been jailed since. Elizabeth Arendt, VOA News, Cairo.
The United States Monday confirmed an earlier report. The Obama administration is bolstering its support role in the hunt for Lord's Resistance Army rebels and their leader, Joseph Kony, by dispatching another 150 Special Forces personnel and deploying aircraft to augment the search. In cooperation with the Ugandan Army, Marie Harf, a U.S. spokesperson.
The president's direction, the United States has deployed CV-22 Ospreys, refueling aircraft and associated support personnel to augment U.S. support for the African Union Regional Task Force counter-LRA mission. This comes, obviously, as the latest step in what we've been very clear is an effort to counter the LRA, including take Joseph Kony off of the battlefield.
The LRA, infamous for forced recruitment of child soldiers, has declined in recent years to some 250 fighters. Kony, wanted by the International Criminal Court for murder and sexual enslavement, is believed to be hiding somewhere in Central African Republic. The death toll from a boat capsize on Lake Albert in Uganda has risen to at least 107. Rescue officials recovered more bodies Monday. Andrew Umbogori, field officer for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, says refugee travel on the lake must be more closely monitored.
We have to enhance our information campaigns in the settlements. We have to do that. We have to tell the refugees when it's safe to return. We have to tell refugees which routes are best to follow. And, you know, so that's a lesson learned. We are doing it, but maybe we need to be more vigorous in informing them, look, overloading of the boats and using routes which are not official and not informing UNHCR that they are going back. This could endanger them.
The boat carrying mostly Congolese refugees tipped over early on Saturday. Investigative reporting helped police in Ghana break up a forced prostitution ring and rescue six Vietnamese women. The ring, allegedly run by two Chinese men out of the coastal city Sekondi Takoradi, was broken up this month thanks in part to the reporting of Anas Aramayo Anas of the New Crusading Guide newspaper. He told VOA it took months for him and Ghanaian police to investigate the case with assistance from the International Criminal Police Organization. He said the victims are being taken care of at a safe place.
They say that they were in Vietnam and somebody came to them and told them in Vietnam that he wanted to take them to Norway and to give them a very good job in Norway. So they were happy about the prospect and they took advantage of that. They were surprised that the flight that took them brought them to Ghana. And then they took them to Tema, and that's when the sexual exploitation started.
He said the women told him they looked for a way to get out, but failed because the traffickers seized their travel documents and they'd had no money. Zambia's Energy and Water Development Minister, Christopher Yaluma, has warned the Kariba Dam is crumbling and in need of urgent repairs, costing tens of millions of dollars. He said the hydroelectric dam's wall, 128 meters high, must be repaired within 3 years. The dam, which straddles Zambia and Zimbabwe, is one of the world's largest and generates more than 1,300 megawatts of power. A collapse could impact four countries with heavy flooding. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. Some of these stories can be found at our internet webpage. That address, once again, voanews.com.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. is deeply concerned about mass death sentences in Egypt as an analyst sees Brotherhood witch hunt.
They are basically saying that the entirety of not only just the Muslim Brotherhood, but anybody who even dares to espouse any kind of support for them are nothing but terrorists. Now, of course, this is a page right out of Mubarak regime's way of suppressing political dissent.
Sabak Makhmoud is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. More troubles for South Sudan peace talks in Addis Ababa. Swaziland unveils a new international airport, but critics call it a pet project for King Mswati III. And an Ebola expert talks about the outbreak in Guinea.
Depending on the species and strain of Ebola, the mortality rates can range anywhere from maybe 40% or so all the way up to 90%. And I think this current outbreak in Guinea, it looks like it may be caused by the Zaire species.
Dr. Thomas Geisberg is a researcher and professor at the University of Texas Medical Branch. More troubles within Zimbabwe's opposition MDC, and a new report says 2013 was the sixth warmest year on record. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United States says it is shocked and deeply concerned by the death sentences handed down to nearly 530 members of Egypt's outlaw Muslim Brotherhood. An Egyptian court on Monday sentenced the members of the Islamist group to death on charges that include the murder of a police officer, attacking a police station, and other acts of violence. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harve said Monday it seems impossible that hundreds of defendants could be tried in accordance with international standards in only 2 days.
We have continued to call on the Egyptian government to ensure that those detained are afforded fair proceedings that respect civil liberties. And as that we've said many, many, many times, that the appearance of politically motivated arrests, detentions, and convictions will just continue to move Egypt's democratic transition backwards and not forward. I think a few points. The first is that we're talking to the Egyptian government. We're trying to ascertain all the facts here. Obviously, as I said, it's a pretty shocking number. But we're gathering all the facts and determining what we do going forward. Our policy towards Egypt all along since July has been governed by a few principles. One is that it's an important relationship, so we don't want to completely cut off the relationship, as you saw when we made a decision about aid. The second is that there are principles that we stand up for that include things like right to a free and fair trial that we will continue pushing with the Egyptian government. And the third is that we will engage with all parties and all groups in Egypt to make sure that as their democratic transition moves forward, it's done so in an inclusive manner.
That's U.S. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harve. Egyptian expert Sabak Makhmoud, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley, has also expressed dismay at Monday's mass sentencing of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood members. She tells me the sentencing is a political witch hunt being carried out by the military-backed government against members of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, I think it's really an outrage that this is happening in Egypt under the military rule that supposedly passed a so-called democratic constitution, but has gone ahead and just sentenced, basically declared the largest death sentence ever in the history of Egypt. And purportedly, the court that made this decision argues that 529 people are responsible for the killing of one police officer. Obviously, the people who are being sentenced to death are supposed to be supporters of the ousted Prime Minister Mohamed Morsi, who was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and this should be understood as a witch hunt that is being carried out against the Muslim Brotherhood.
What does it say here about the rule of due process? Is it being followed in Egypt at the moment?
Well, it's clearly not being followed in Egypt at all. Due process is nowhere in sight in Egypt. And we not only see evidence of that in this ridiculous sentence that has been passed, even if you were going to, for example, indict somebody who killed a police officer, you can't indict a crowd, furthermore, that was actually exercising their political right to protest. You can take even perhaps elements from that crowd who may have broken the law and so on, but to actually actually sentenced close to 530 people, 529 to be precise, nowhere can be defended legally. Most of the people who have been arrested are being tried in military courts and security courts under the emergency law in the country. They're not being given a fair trial.
Professor, I know a few Egyptian friends, and some of them, when you talk to them about this, the interesting thing is that they seem to welcome this type of crackdown because of their belief that the government is fighting against terrorism.
Yes, that's really one of the covers that the military government has taken. They are basically saying that the entirety of not only just the Muslim Brotherhood, but anybody who even dares to espouse any kind of support for them are nothing but terrorists. Now, of course, this is a page right out of Mubarak regime's a way of suppressing political dissent.
The State Department spokesperson I heard on the news expressing disbelief also about the sentencing.
Well, I think the State Department reaction throughout this process has been completely muted. We must remember that Egypt is the second largest recipient of U.S. military and socioeconomic aid after Israel in the region. And the United States has an enormous influence in how Egyptian politics is conducted. Ever since the overthrow of the Morsi government, the writing has been on the wall. This is not the first time that the military has violated basic liberties, civil and political liberties, although this is one of the more egregious examples of it. This has not inspired or pushed the U.S. government to say, okay, you have to actually cease this way of acting and we will, political, economic, and military aid will be withdrawn. But the U.S. government has really not done that under Obama.
Sabak Makmu is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. She spoke with me from Berkeley, California. South Sudan's government is rejecting the participation of seven former detainees who have not been charged with any crime as a third party to the talks in Addis Ababa aimed at ending the country's three-month-old conflict. The talks are expected to restart sometime this week. IGA mediators had proposed that the SPLM leaders be allowed to participate in the talks to hopefully help end the crisis. But Juba has written a letter of protest. Mugume Devirakeringi reports from Juba.
Foreign Affairs spokesperson Mawin Makol Arik reiterated the government's position that the released seven political detainees must not play any role in the peace talks.
They are detainees, they are suspects, and they were out there for bail. So the court needs them back here to come and stand the trial. So you cannot include in the negotiation process people that are wounded by the court.
Whether or not include the seven SPLM leaders as a third and a separate delegation of the talks was one of the things that stalled this latest round of negotiations. Despite the disagreement over the seven detainees' participation, Arik says the talks will go forward.
We have a delegation. Some of them left yesterday to Addis, and some have gone today. And there will be some preliminary hearings starting the talk of tomorrow.
2 weeks ago, the judge presiding over the treason trial of four other political detainees ordered the seven released detainees to testify at a special court in Juba. So far, the seven who are released to the custody of Kenya have not returned to Juba. But he is hoping for the best at the talks in the Ethiopian capital.
Well, we hope that the talks will go well, go smoothly, and I think this is what the government here needs.
SPLM opposition spokesperson Hussein Mar Nyot was not available for comment as his phone was switched off. But the opposition have stated in the past they want inclusive talks in which all stakeholders are at the table. After more than 3 months of fighting, the only achievement so far has been the signing of cessation of hostilities agreement, an agreement that has been repeatedly violated by both sides of the conflict. For VOA News, I am Mugume Devsiru-Akarinj in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 25th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Swaziland has officially opened the newly constructed King Mswati III International Airport, estimated to initially cost about $150 million as part of the country's Millennium Development Goals. Government spokesman Percy Simelane says the airport is also a component of King Mswati III $1 billion Millennium Project investment initiative, but critics say it is a white elephant pet project of the king. Spokesman Similani tells reporter Peter Clotty that the newly unveiled airport will enable Swaziland to fairly compete with neighboring South Africa to attract international investors.
The modern airport that we have just officially opened is one of our MDGs, Millennium Development Goal Project. And it took longer than we had expected because of our financial position. We were kind of not as stable as we used to be, but it's complete now. We're happy that finally we have a modern airport, and it is named King Mswati III International Airport. It is one of our Millennium Development Projects. It comes after another. We had a huge water project, usually called the LUSIP, the Lower Usutu Irrigation Project, which is benefiting thousands of people downstream. So this one is one of those projects that we had earmarked as one of our MDGs.
What do you say to critics who say that the government did not make judicious use of the country's resources by constructing this airport, especially when the people are so poor and they say people are not necessarily going to benefit fully from this ultra-modern airport?
There was a feasibility study which pointed to the fact that it was going to be a viable project. It did not come from just one minister suggesting that an airport should be built. There was a feasibility study, and the feasibility study pointed to the fact that this airport was going to be viable, particularly because we had a very small airport at Matsapa near Manzini, which did not have the range to take bigger aircraft. So this time around, this one, any aircraft can land there. When Matsapa could not take bigger aircraft, that meant our cargo from all over the world was dropped in South Africa, and we had to go fetch it in trucks or the railway. This time around, we're going to have that airport, and it's bringing a lot of other projects.
Well, talking about feasibility study, people have expressed concern that this airport was a pet project of the king, and that the supporters of the king or ministers of the king would say and defend whatever the king wants. As such, this, their words, not mine, that this is just a white elephant.
It is not going to be a white elephant. In the beginning, people used to say that it was not going to be completed in the first place. It was going to remain an uncompleted project. We proved them wrong. We are still going to prove them wrong. The king is a head of state. Each time there is a project, he knows about it, and if he supports it, he has to support it and support his government, support his people. The people of Swaziland are going to benefit from this airport in terms of jobs and other projects that are going to be part of the project. Already people have been given free land to develop projects around the airport.
Percy Similani is the spokesman for Swaziland's government. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Mbabane. The confusion in the Movement for Democratic Change formation of former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai continued on Monday at the party's headquarters, where a provincial meeting that had been called to deal with a leadership problem in the Chitungwiza province was called off. Thomas Churipasi of VOA Zimbabwe program has details.
Divisions in the MDCT continued to be exposed at the party's Harvest House headquarters, where the party's Chitungwiza provincial leadership managed to block the party structures from passing a vote of no confidence in them at the last minute, albeit temporarily. The opposition structures for Chitungwiza province had convened at the party's offices, reportedly to pass a vote of no confidence in the chairperson and other unnamed provincial members, suspected to be aligned to suspended Deputy Treasurer General of the MDCT, Elton Mangoma, who is calling for Tsvangirai to quit his post following the MDCT's drubbing in last year's national elections at the hands of President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party. The MDCT's provincial chairperson for Chitungwiza, Alexio Musundire, said the meeting was rolled over to Friday this week because it was unconstitutional.
It was an illegal meeting. That meeting was not sanctioned either by the provincial executive or by the president of the party through the national organizing secretary. It was an illegal meeting.
Some MDCT members who attended the meeting but refused to speak on tape, fearing reprisals, told Studio 7 that the party's national organizing secretary, Nelson Chamisa, who is also in Mr. Changrai's camp, caused the meeting to be cancelled. Efforts to get a comment from Chamisa were fruitless. However, some sources said the meeting was cancelled because Mr. Changrai feared that there could be violence ahead of his meeting with diplomats tomorrow. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Health officials say an outbreak of hemorrhagic fever linked to the Ebola virus has now killed 59 people in Guinea. The World Health Organization reports a total of 86 suspected Ebola cases in Guinea, 13 of which have been confirmed by lab results. Dr. Thomas Geisbert has researched the disease for more than 25 years. He is currently a professor at the University of Texas Medical Branch. Dr. Geisbert tells reporter Ricky Shryak the current Ebola strain outbreak in Guinea could likely be the Zaire strain, one of the deadliest strains of all.
Depending on the species and strain of Ebola, the mortality rates can range anywhere from maybe 40% or so all the way up to 90%. And I think this current outbreak in Guinea, from what I'm hearing, it looks like it may be caused by the Zaire species. And that particular species is associated with the highest case fatality rate, which again, in some outbreaks have been 90%.
If Ebola is only spread through contact with bodily fluids and not, say, airborne method, how is it so contagious?
A number of reasons. It only requires a few virus particles to initiate an infection. So with a lot of different microorganisms, you need to get a fairly high dose of the agent to cause, you know, a lethal infection. With Ebola, just, you know, one or two virus particles can trigger disease and result in death. So, you know, the low number of particles to initiate a productive infection is one of the things that probably makes it so deadly. A lot of times in some of the outbreaks, they're initiated or triggered by a non-human primate, a gorilla, great apes. Ebola has decimated populations of great apes in the Congo Basin. And so what happens is, bushmeat is part of the diet there in that part of the world. And, you know, somebody comes in contact with butchers a chimpanzee or a gorilla or some kind of a monkey that died from Ebola. And then, you know, through the process of that, you know, somebody catches it and, you know, can spread it to other people.
When was the first case of Ebola reported?
1976. There were two concurrent outbreaks with two different species of Ebola. One was the Zaire species in the former Zaire, and the other was the Sudan species in Sudan.
It is named after the Ebola River in the country formerly known as Zaire.
Correct.
When was the deadliest outbreak?
I think there's probably been two. The initial outbreak in 1976 was very, you know, I think high 88, 90%. And then one of the deadliest was the outbreak in Kikwit in 1995, where you had, you know, the 88 to 90% mortality.
In DRC?
In DRC.
You mentioned the percentage of mortality. Do you remember how many people died from these outbreaks?
95, you had several hundred cases.
Is there ongoing work to discover a cure or a treatment of any sort? Because as I understand it, there is no treatment at all.
That is correct. The United States government has put a lot of money, NIH in particular, has put a lot of money into developing effective countermeasures against Ebola. After 9/11, the U.S. government took a particular interest in a lot of different pathogens that had high mortality rates, and Ebola is currently listed as a Tier 1 agent, and that means it's one of the high-priority pathogens for developing effective countermeasures.
Dr. Thomas Gasper is a researcher and professor at the University of Texas Medical Branch. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Galveston, Texas. The World Meteorological Organization says 2013 was the sixth warmest year on record, confirming the long-term global warming is continuing. In its annual report on the status of the climate, WMO describes a pattern of extreme weather events across the planet. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The World Meteorological Organization finds 13 of the 14 warmest years on record have occurred in the 21st century, and it says each of the last three decades has been warmer than the previous one, with 2001 to 2010 being the warmest decade on record. WMO Secretary General Michel Jarraud tells VOA it is important to look beyond individual years in order to assess the global warming trend. He says within this trend, there's significant variability in weather patterns, but he adds 2013 definitely confirms a continuation of this trend.
Since 2001, the first year of this new century, the coldest year that we have observed since 2001 is actually warmer than any year before 1998. So I don't think this can be used in seen in contradiction of a stop in the climate change.
That's correspondent Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with volleyball. Libya's El Ahli Tripoli dismissed Bou Vallon of the Seychelles in three straight sets as Egypt's El Ahli beat Cameroon's FAP Yaounde in a similar fashion in Group D action at the Africa Men's Club Volleyball Championships in Sousse, Tunisia on Monday. In Group C, Tunisia's Esperance dismissed Kenya's General Service Unit and Libya's El Ahli Benghazi outplayed Ethiopia's Mugar Cement. Consequently, Esperance, El Ahli Benghazi, El Ahli Tripoli and Egypt's El Ahli progressed to the quarterfinals. In the quarterfinals, which will be dominated by North African clubs, they join Algeria's Etoile Setif, Bord Bou Ariadi, along with Tunisia's defending champion CS Sfaxien and Etoile du Sahel, who booked their places in the last eight on Sunday. Turning to football, Nigerian midfielder Aminat Yakub He was voted player of the match when Nigeria thrashed Mexico 3-0 at the FIFA Women's Under-17 World Cup in San Jose, Costa Rica on Monday. Nigeria joined Canada, Ghana, Japan, Italy, Mexico, Spain and Venezuela, who qualified for the quarterfinals due on Thursday. In disability sports, African champions Algeria have been drawn in Group C at the World Wheelchair Basketball Championships. According to the draws conducted in Incheon, South Korea on Saturday, Algeria, who are the only Africans among the 16 teams at the contest, play Colombia, Turkey and the United States of America in the group stage. The two-week contest starts in Incheon on the 3rd of July. Finally, in athletics, Ethiopian Shemu Hailu and Geda Ayelu Lem won the men's and women's events at the Rome Marathon in Italy on Sunday. Staying in Italy, Kenya's Thomas Lokomwa and Lucy Wambui Murigi prevailed in the Stra Milano Half Marathon in Milan. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Our listener mail for this Tuesday morning comes from Kalisa Beno of Kigali in Rwanda. He says, Dear VOA, I want to send my condolences to all the people of Guinea, most especially those who have lost their beloved ones because of Ebola. I call for the immediate intervention of the World Health Organization to save the innocent civilians. I also call on the African Union to set up an epidemic emergency fund that will be used in the case of emergencies such as the one in Guinea. We thank you, Kalisa Beno of Kigali in Rwanda. Rwanda for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. That's it for this Tuesday, March 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Button in Washington, wishing everybody in Africa a very good day.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African music mix on the Voice of America. VOA. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Tune in from 0 to 300 hours UTC and from 11 to 1300 hours UTC every single day on the Voice of America.